Hi, I'm Zoe Clark, and this is Without Borders. Today, we're speaking to Peter Gillingwater, the CEO of Radiate and Managing Director of NextSec Leaders.
Hi, and I'm Brendan Craigie. And on this episode, Peter's going to be sharing his secrets to building winning teams. He's going to be talking about his top advice for expanding internationally. And finally, what makes Peter run a mile when interviewing.
My son just turned 18.
Wow.
So he can take me to the pub now.
Nice.
Hasn't yet.
No.
But I've got 20 of his friends turning up on Friday night to drink my alcohol.
Nice.
So that's fun. Amy's, apparently she's got about to win another sort of advertising sort of Instagram pitch with a retail brand. I mean, she's just flying. So that's...
What does she do?
She's a semi-pro skateboarding model on Instagram.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah. Okay.
Her handle is Skate Middleton.
Brilliant. Yeah. Skate Middleton.
Nice.
And she's now got 25,000 followers. And
wow.
She's the face of Boohoo in the recent campaign.
Did you teach her how to skate?
Do you know what? I've had nothing to do with what's happened the last four or 5 years. I've just stepped back and watched. Yeah.
Yeah. But, excellent.
So we don't have a quiet house.
No. Brilliant.
What should we talk about today?
Peter, you know, one of the things you're heavily involved in is helping people to go international. What are your sort of main bits of advice for any sort of entrepreneurs thinking about going international?
I think it's first of all, being prepared to work incredibly hard and realize that it's going to be very difficult. And, you know, you've got to really pay attention to detail. You've got to have the right team around you. You've got to have the right resources around you, you know, and then you may have a chance.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not for the faint-hearted. And you've also got to have a global outlook. You've got to sort of think internationally. You can't think like a Brit going on tour or a Kiwi coming up for a summer in London. This is about, being a global citizen.
Yeah. No, as someone who went to the States to work on a previous business there and sort of grow that, it's totally, we roughly speak the same language, but just in terms of understanding how business works in a different country, it took me like 12 to 18 months to get up to speed. You know, and even then I'm probably... when I say up to speed, probably still at a massive disadvantage to anyone else that was there. And that was my biggest learning, was actually you needed senior people around you that knew the local market, and didn't matter whatever genius you were in the place you came from, if you're operating in a different market, you're not going to be able to navigate that by yourself.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there's cultural nuances as well, and those sort of things. What happens in Germany may be offensive in another location, so you have to be very careful.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a lot of experience doing this. I mean, how have you seen things change? What's the market like at the moment? Give us a bit of a sense of how things are for companies wanting to come over to the UK and Europe.
Well, certainly, with a certain US president in place, throwing bombs into trade agreements, I think it's actually a very good thing because what it is doing is stirring up people's mentalities around doing international trade and expansion. So, in fact, I was at an event this morning and their report, this is a US sort of focused event, they're seeing more activity of UK companies looking to enter into the US to do business and vice versa. And obviously there's a Brexit effect as well. And I think, what is happening is that people are beginning to sort of sit up and say, actually, things are changing. It's not going to be the same old norm. It's now time to maybe, be brave. And I think all this sort of chaos and uncertainty is actually causing people to actually think, well, actually, now's time to do it. So if anything, it's actually bizarrely really quite a good thing.
Mm. Yeah, interesting.
I guess if you're trying to build a successful business and... you can sort of see a lot of runway for your business in a particular market. I mean, do you ever encounter business where you think, actually, why on earth are you thinking about you know, going international? Why don't you just actually just focus on what you're doing and do a really good job at that in that local market and like fulfill the full potential of where you are as opposed to going international? Is there not sometimes the argument just to think this is a distraction?
Of course. I mean, in fact, you know, what I'm seeing in talking with Australian companies at the moment, you know, there was a period of time where they were very comfortable, you know, doing stuff in their own markets. 25 million people, you know, pretty sort of close in terms of geography, only a few time zones. And of course, you know, they were getting lots of trade with China. And so, you know, the economy was very good and it hasn't had a recession for more than 30 years. So people were living the lifestyle, you know, so working pretty hard, going to the beach and having barbecues. But, you know, things have changed. And I think, you know, individuals are beginning to realize that you can't necessarily just think locally. And it comes a bit down to ambition, you know, what you want to try and achieve. And some businesses should not export. Some businesses should only focus on local markets. But if you've got something that has global potential, then I question why you're doing it if you don't think that actually let's do it globally as opposed to locally.
Mm. What I find quite interesting is how much, you touched on it, ambition, how much people's personal appetite for life is also tied up with like the business expansion. I mean, just thinking about some of the entrepreneurs that we both know, you know, recently entered the UK market, that there is also like a bit of a life journey going on as well in terms of, you know, the people wanting to experience living in another market, trying, taking on a different experience. I mean, and I know certainly from my own experience, like wanting to live in the States, that was very much tied up with, you know, just wanting to try living in a different world. So it was as much a personal life challenge as it was a career challenge.
Yeah, I mean, some people, you know, never have any ambition at all, and that's fine. And other people have tons of ambition till the day they die. And I think certainly, you know, individuals I know that, you know, should be even thinking about, you know, slowing down or, you know, even semi-retiring. I'm seeing more of a trend, actually. You know, I've got a longer runway of life expectancy. So, you know, whereas you maybe your parents definitely retired before they were 70, and then you, you know, sort of had those initial thinking when you into the workforce. Now people are living, you know, very actively until 80 and 90 plus. So, you know, to sort of think about retirement in your mid-50s, you know, you may have another 35 years of active fit life to use up. And that's a lot of rounds of golf. Or, you know, and so, no. I mean, you know, if you're still active, healthy, fit, and your brain's still good, use it properly. And that, to me, is not just about, you know, a good life or family life, but it's also your business life.
Yeah. And so I think through the years that you've worked, do you always see ambition as a good thing? Like, as in, is ambition integral to having a happy life? Or do you think that sometimes, like, you know, sometimes I wonder, I think some psychologists have sort of said that that sometimes the secret to happiness is having low expectations.
It's an element of being happy with what you've got, right?
It can
be a struggle if you're constantly striving.
I personally am, like my wife has told me, you're never happy. You know, like you are always wanting to do the next thing. You know, whether it be buying a house, renovating a house, or, you know,
moving country.
She's like, you know, you're never happy. You always want to do something else. Like, I'm not quite sure I figured out how to deal with that.
What, Ellen?
I've not figured out how to deal with my wife, but I've also not quite figured out how to deal with myself.
Yeah, maybe ambition is not necessarily the right word here. I mean, it's really, I suppose, having a sense of purpose, you know, and feeling that you're doing the best you can and, you know, achieving, you know, I suppose, the optimum output of, you know, your life. You know, whether that's a high work ethos, you know, I mean, you know, my dad was world class at getting, you know, us boys jobs during every school holiday. You know, I did paper rounds from the age of 9, so I've always worked.
Yeah.
And therefore, I can't not work.
Yeah.
And so if I'm going to work, I'm able to do something that's fun and meaningful, worthwhile. Yeah. If it makes a ton of money, that helps. But that's not what drives me. I mean, I know I'm not driven really by money, although I use it. It's more about, you know, achievement and, you know, having fun, but also the challenge.
Yeah.
And sometimes the challenge is not easy. And in fact, it can be painful. And in fact, it can be really quite destructive at times.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's the up and down piece.
Is that one of the things that you tell your businesses and advise them when they're beginning to think about this? I'm just kind of thinking, where do they start? Like, what are the top pieces of advice you'd be thinking to give someone?
Yeah, I mean, it's you don't want to sort of tell them it's going to be too hard too early. Yeah. Otherwise, it'll put them off. Yeah. But I mean, I think you have to keep the expectations real. You know, and, you know, in fact, I was thinking about this, you know, not just on the way here, but over recent days and weeks, you know, companies I'm quite close to, and, you know, I can see that they, you know, have so much more potential than they're achieving, and partly down to the fact that they have issues around decision-making, issues around trust, issues around, you know, just getting on with it. And that's quite a common problem. So, you know, I think what I do urge you know, founders and leaders of businesses to try and think about here is alignment of the team, you know, making sure that you communicate really well. And that's hard at the best of times, but also making sure that you try and avoid things like conflict. Most conflicts are unhealthy, some is good. You know, you really got to start a business with, you know, as much intent as possible as well, and realize it's not going to be an easy journey.
Mm. Yeah.
So when you start thinking about expanding a business internationally, I presume there's a huge amount of planning and thought that would need to go in before you obviously take that step. But for the businesses maybe who've done that, they've jumped in, they now find themselves having grown quite quickly, and maybe they now operate in multiple geographies, whereas they, you know, started out just as one, and they maybe need to catch up a little bit in terms of, you know, they've become something bigger than they thought they would be. Is that something you ever find or you ever encounter?
Of course. I mean, you know, I've been lucky enough to work with some pretty amazing companies that have done extremely well. There's not many of them, to be fair. I mean, you know, you hear about the unicorns and, the billion-dollar-plus valuations. I mean, there's a relatively small number of those. And the companies that have done over 100 million of revenue, they're still, you know, relatively small numbers as well. So, yeah, and you don't have to sort of measure it by revenue, but I think, you know, companies do have to adjust a lot to go, you know, truly international. You know, things do change around the way the organizations are structured, roles change continuously, you know, the way that, you know, businesses are run operationally change and evolve. And so, you know, what is quite common is that the teams normally have to change. So the evolution of the team, the founding team invariably is not the same team, you know, halfway down the track or, you know, as they go really large internationally, because it's a different kind of skill set. Some founders do the whole trip. In fact, we did some research probably about 8-9 years ago now, and, you know, only around 8% of founders do the whole journey to an exit, and not even as CEO. You know, they stay in the business. The rest, you know, leave for whatever reason, sometimes, you know, positively, sometimes not, during that journey. So it is, you know, it's rare for sort of someone to make the whole journey by themselves.
What do you think the fun years, when are the fun years, like, in the growth thing versus when does it start to become, you know,
tough,
bureaucratic and stale? I don't know, like, when if you could be part of any business at the beginning, what would you say are the most exciting years for a company?
Well, you know, certainly it comes a little bit down to numbers of people as well. I mean, if you can remember everyone's name and, you know, a bit about their background and family life and so forth. But once you get it to about 20 plus people, then it starts getting harder and then 25, 30. So I think it depends also whether you're in the same unit or you're spread around the world a little bit as well. But the fun shouldn't stop whilst you're growing or indeed shrinking. Sometimes shrinking is not a bad thing, but the fun, you know, element, you need to try and keep that in there. And that's sort of a cultural thing, but also it's a mindset thing as well.
Yeah.
And you could be having a terrible day, but, you know, it could still be fun.
Yeah. So obviously you're involved in helping companies to build teams. To use a football analogy, because always it's important to get in a football analogy. People talk about, like, winning teams in football or soccer for the Americans. It's about having the spine of the team. You know, the spine of the team is what allows you to win, like, cups and championships. You know, having the great goalkeeper, great central defender, great central midfielder, great striker, you know, like, running through the team, the spine of the team. When you think about companies, you know, growing, what does the spine of the team need to look like for like a successful technology company? Not necessarily in terms of role positions, but just what does a successful business need in terms of characteristics from that leadership team to be successful?
Of course, the greatest sporting team in history is the All Blacks.
Right.
Being a Kiwi, I would say that.
Yeah.
And you know, I look at them as actually a very good sort of metaphor for business, and a lot of things they do work very well in business too. And then the spine, I suppose, is around leadership. And that's not necessarily about how many caps you have or how new you are to the business or indeed how long you've been there as well, but it's taking on responsibility and sharing the load. So I think a successful business is best served by having leaders, and it doesn't necessarily mean role titles or seniority, but actually showing leadership across the business, sharing ideas, collaboration, not undermining colleagues, just showing the way forward.
Yes.
And that could be the person on your front reception.
Yes.
It could be anyone.
Yeah.
But leadership to me is really important as the proper spine of any organization.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point, actually. And to use another football analogy, like my team that I support has, they have a captain, but actually if you look through the rest of the team, a lot of the people that they've acquired, to strengthen that team have all been captained in their previous clubs. So you've almost got like a team of captains, and I think that's sort of in a way what you need, isn't it? Like I think a successful team is everyone takes the same, feels entitled to and encouraged to and does take the same level of responsibility and, like leadership.
Absolutely. And it's not about egos, in fact, harking back again to the All Blacks. I mean, they've got a phrase called cleaning the shed. So after each match, it's up to all the players, including the captain and the senior players, to make sure that the dressing room is cleared out, and it's that the captain is the last person to leave. So it's no egos. You're not too big for the team.
Yeah.
That will be, shall we say, stomped upon. And I think companies, you can have your characters. And, some companies obviously have their flamboyant CEOs and founders that are great in front of the press. And, we know that some of them can be quite destructive as well. But I think if you've got, this blend of leadership and also just without the big egos, then once again, you're perhaps reducing the risk for conflict. Which once again is destructive.
Yeah.
So that's the strengths of a team and what's absolutely necessary. But what are some of the pitfalls that you've witnessed?
What, of teams?
Yeah, and companies trying to grow and expand.
Yeah, I mean, it's a trust thing, and I think, knowing that someone will be there when they say they will be and, they're not out to sort of replace you or indeed, I mean, I've been through this myself personally and I have some sort of battle scars and I know, what it's like to have difficult times around, that sort of team breaking up. You have to be very aware that, there are going to be some political elements going on. There are going to be some cultural things that are going to destroy a company potentially. And so you just have to be on the lookout for these things. Look for signs when, whether it's around the water cooler or, someone sort of mentions in your ear that in fact, there's things going on. So you just have to be tuned into the noise of the business and making sure that, if there are potential issues, you manage them, you deal with them, you don't have to sort of destroy them. You just have to sort of work out how to fix them.
Yeah. Is that speaking from experience of businesses you've been in or experience?
Absolutely.
You've been,
I mean, most companies will experience this in their lifetime in terms of, the way that teams can break up and cultural mismatches. And, sometimes it's down to new people coming in, so they're perhaps like almost like a virus because they haven't been chosen correctly, they haven't been selected properly, there's a cultural mismatch. Or indeed, you'd get people that have been in a business for a while and they go through a life event or something happens and suddenly they change. And that could also be a viral effect to a business.
Definitely. So you're a big believer in being really open and kind of warts and all at work, are you? And kind of sharing lots about, what's going on in personal life as well.
Yeah,
as
we only have one life and, you don't want to burden your colleagues with everything that's going on. But at the same time, you need to keep it real. And, if you do have a problem at home, with a member of the family or if something is going on that's sort of distracting you or causing you issues, if you don't tell them, they don't know. Yeah. And they wonder why you're a grumpy bugger.
Yeah.
Or they wonder why you're not so here. So, you know, by being more open, and you don't have to publish it on online to everyone,
sure.
but you tell a few key people that, in fact, you know, I'm having a tough time, you know, for whatever reason, then people are going to be much more understanding and not so much forgiving, but they can accept that you know, today's not a good day for you.
Yeah, no, I think that's something that, as funny, so as someone who sort of, I always look quite young and obviously was quite young when, well, I am still relatively young, but when I was in a leadership position quite young, I was always determined to, I was always saying, you know, you can't measure experience in years, which I think is true. But ultimately, there is something about life experience that makes you a more rounded person. And I think as you get a bit older, you realize that people do have like crappy life events that happen, you know, not throughout, not for necessarily of their own, you know, their own causing, you know, whether it be bereavements or, you know, relationships. And I think having a level of empathy and understanding around that is something you only really learn from encountering it yourself, I think.
Yeah, and I can wholeheartedly say that there's been times where I've been impatient and intolerant and actually said the wrong thing, or in fact, there's quite a few times I've said the wrong thing. But you know, and I suppose an older me would not have done that.
Yeah.
So how to sort of perhaps pass on those life messages to the, you know, younger up and coming staff? I don't know. It's not simple as that. But you know, certainly I've definitely mellowed and got better, I think, in terms of how I deal with stuff. You know, I think perhaps cultures and businesses have changed a lot over the last 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, no longer hierarchical, much flatter. You know, obviously with new generations coming in, the millennials, you know, have a very different viewpoint to how they work. And in fact, I've even got a Generation Z member of the team at the moment.
What year were they born?
Will was born in 2000. And, you know, he's quite a phenomenal young man who has a big career ahead of him. You know, he's about to go to university in America. He's another Kiwi. But he's over here sort of doing a few months work experience. And in fact, he's teaching me stuff. You know, he comes in at 11:30 in the morning. I don't complain, you know, because he needs to sleep in. But he works late and he does stuff that I couldn't even hope to do.
Yeah, music I find is a very dating thing. Like, you know, like as in I was listening to some music and someone was saying, oh, I think I recognise this band. Who is it? I was like, you are kidding me, aren't you? You know, it was you too. I think it's like probably one of the greatest like rock bands of the last, you know, of the, you know, last few decades. Mm. And I was looking at it and I saw it looking at when this particular track was first released. It was like 1991. And I was sort of saying, oh, you know, you were 11 then. And they say, oh, no, I was one. You know, like just getting my decades mixed up. And you forget how time passes by so quickly. It's quite scary.
I mean, clearly the tech industry is constantly evolving. There's all these new things going on. But do you think that the industry is doing enough to kind of harness that amazing talent that Generation Z, et cetera, have, you know, to get them involved in the industry for work, for jobs, as customers?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the tech industry has done extremely well in evolution and continues to sort of push boundaries and change the world and innovate. So you know, there's no doubt that roles will change and, you know, the size of companies, I'm sure, will change and, you know, the sort of hybrid type situations involving tech and what you do are going to certainly happen. But if you look at, say, the average 18-year-old, I mean, their mobile phones actually never leave within 1 inch of their body, even in bed or even in the shower, if it comes to my kids. You know, I certainly didn't grow up anywhere near that kind of attachment to a device. Didn't have devices back then. But, you know, certainly it means that they will be more productive in a different kind of way.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just what humans are very good at doing.
Yeah.
Although I do question how fast they can adapt to the acceleration of change.
Yeah.
And I think that some people do it very well and will continue to evolve. But, you know, studies are showing us that a proportion of humanity are struggling with keeping up with that change. So there may be, I'm not suggesting a split in the way that Homo sapiens are evolving, but, you know, it's something to consider here is that technology will create a divide in places. But, yeah, by and large, it's going to be positive.
Do you?
Yeah.
So I think there is there's always an obsession with youth. You know, and it's I think in tech, you know, it's off. There is a focus on youth, a lot of like young founders and so on. I just wonder, do you think that the industry is guilty of writing people off at a relatively early age? You know, like I think as in, you know, is there a stigma associated with being old in the tech sector? You know, like do you know what I mean? Do you think we actually don't value experience enough?
I think certainly it's an issue that, you know, will always be there. You know, and it depends also what kind of business you are. You know, if you're a social media or an online sort of play around gaming and so forth, you know, that's not normally a place where you find a 55-year-old sort of hanging out. However, if it's like enterprise software selling into senior people in a bank, then that's, you know, absolutely tailor-made. But I do find, you know, there is definitely ageism out there. Just like, you know, there's diversity issues, sexism still exists. It's improving for sure. But, you know, what I always say to companies is, you know, is judge someone on their, not just their experience, but also their motivations and their energy. You know? And, you know, I've met some 55-year-olds that are just phenomenally energetic, and they will, you know, they'll come in with the goods and overachieve and do it, you know, serenely. So, you know, certainly given my vintage years, I'm not ageist at all, quite the opposite. Yeah. And I think it's fit for purpose. You've got to sort of figure out, you know, cultural, it's got to fit, you know, so the person's got to fit into the team. And, I mean, I'm working with a young company down in Croydon at the moment, and the average age is probably at 24, 25. They're in the enterprise space. They're trying to hire someone quite senior, and I get it. You know, a 55-year-old probably wouldn't sort of fit in there. So we just have to sort of, you know, figure out what's going to be the right fit. But you know, you just have to realize that you know, the match has to be good.
Yeah. So you obviously, as we talked about, how you help a lot of companies build teams and identify talent. So you've been involved in countless, you know, processes like that. What are your sort of like, what are the sort of like the things that you really look for in talent? And what are the, and you know, from a positive sense, and what are the things that you know, that make you run a mile?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's an authentic sort of communication style, you know, and having done God knows how many thousands of interviews and, you know, and assess people and so forth. So you get an intuition, you know, and you can't help it. And, you know, literally within a few minutes, I can tell whether someone's being authentic and a good person. You know, in other words, quality in terms of capability and experience doesn't always work, but it's pretty close to, you know, being a good way of sort of judging these things. But I think certainly, you know, you need to assess someone based upon their story, you know, what they've done, how they tell it, but also to be, you know, I suppose also show their weaknesses and, you know, where they've failed, and, you know, just to sort of realize, make them, I suppose, come across in a natural way where, you know, you're having a conversation almost like this as opposed to an interview. And I think some companies still maintain a very rigid interview approach and have, you know, ways and means of testing something. But, you know, my approach is, you know, if someone really interviews well, then I'll just validate that by doing some background checks and just making sure, you know, my judgment's what it seems to be.
Yeah. And what about, like, maybe that's tied up in the same answer that you've just given, but what makes you run a mile?
When quite quickly I can figure out, actually, you know, there's a strong smell of BS and in fact, you know, they're talking about someone else. You know, they're sort of telling a story about someone else that either they know or the person they want to be. And it comes across. Very few people are good liars. I mean, you know, really. I mean, it's the sort of eye movement and their hand gestures and you know. So certainly, you know, that puts me off very, very quickly. I'll tend to close down a conversation quite quickly. But also, I suppose it's also that sort of body language thing as well. You know, the handshake and that physical interaction, the eye contact, and you know, it's and the banter. So, you know, every meeting I try and, you know, I'm not funny, but I try and sort of, you know, talk about what happened yesterday and, you know, just trivial parts of life to see how they react and how they respond and how they interact. And if you don't get anything back, you go, well, you know, that's there's something odd here.
So you spend a lot of time with these people, right? You've got to actually get on.
You got to like them. It really helps.
I mean, it sounds like from what you're saying, that it's those social skills are often the difference between people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big, big factor.
Yeah.
Having said that, even the most popular person may not be very good at their jobs.
No.
In fact, some people, you know, excel at being social. In fact, that's where they're superb at being social, and their job is secondary.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to be a bit careful about someone that perhaps plans parties for them and their friends all the time.
Obviously, without giving any details of names or anything or companies, have you ever had any, like, you know, do you have any anecdotes of any, like, incredible things that you've witnessed, which you've, you know, like, I don't know. Any funny stories?
Oh, plenty over the years. I mean, one of actually involves a business I was a director of, you know, a long time ago, and we were doing a lot of business in America, and the US client said, "You guys will, you know, do really well over here. Come and set up, and we'll help you. You can use some of our office space." And this is in Dallas, and so off we went, and you know, we found, you know, what seemed to be the ideal guy called Brett. I won't say any more than that because it was a long time ago. You know, he joined us and it was fantastic. And then, you know, within a few weeks, the pipeline of business was looking amazing. Then after 3 months, it was like, wow, this guy is just a rock star. And then 4 months came in and revenues weren't coming in. And then 5 months and the pipeline got bigger and bigger, but no revenues. And so we knew there was something wrong. And we sort of asked a few friends to sort of just monitor his activities. And over that five-month period, it turned out his golf handicap went from 12 to 2 in fact, was making it all up.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, that's once again a good lesson learned around proper monitoring.
Yeah.
And giving too much trust.
I had a somewhat similar experience in that I used to actually work in recruitment consulting myself many years ago and worked for quite a large firm. And a guy joined on the same day I did. And obviously over the first few months, the main task, I don't know if it's you're familiar with this, but name collecting, where you have to sort of build up this bank of people who might be interested in switching jobs, which is quite a hard kind of cold calling task that you have to do over a few months. And this guy and I carried on doing this, persevering, plugging away. I wasn't really enjoying it, but getting on with it, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out ultimately after a few months that he was actually still employed by his previous employer, a much smaller headhunting firm. And he was basically like scraping our database and stealing lists and lists and lists of names, went back to his previous, much smaller firm and gave them all our company's intel.
Yeah, I remember one amusing story. It wasn't amusing actually really for anyone at the time, but you know, it was during the sort of the opening up of the sort of central European marketplaces to, you know, new technologies and new companies. And so therefore the number of people that really knew what they were doing was quite limited. And there was one individual that, you know, we sort of got to know and we thought, he's good, you know, and we put him into a role and, you know, off he went. The company seemed pretty happy. I mean, he was doing okay. And then sort of we found out about a year later, he had taken on 4 jobs at the same time, employed by 4 different companies, getting 4 salaries. You know, effectively was not really doing much work at all or trying to sort of divide his time. So once again, you've got to be careful
about...
People
are ingenious, aren't they, when you think you're just getting on with life.
Maybe I might save that towards the end of retirement, you know, try that one out.
Gosh. We want to ask you about your ideal working environment, because as you know, at Taito, we work to a quite a different model and we're all over the place and we can work from anywhere we like. We're not constrained to particular boundaries of a desk or of a particular office. So we have an ingenious little segment called Desert Island Desks. And we would like to know where your desert island desk would be if you could work anywhere in the world with any setup or process. What would it look like?
That's good. It's a great question because, you know, I've worked in so many different environments.
Exactly.
I've seen so many different environments.
I
remember going to a US company box in the valley, and they had a slide from the sort of second to first floor. But I wouldn't have a slide, but I've seen quite a few. And I think, what for me works best, I mean, location wise, I think, you know, if it's, we're talking about successful business as opposed to lifestyle, yeah?
Well, so whatever you want.
I mean, yeah, let's talk about successful business. You know, you need to be close to your customers, close enough. You need to have, you know, access to your team. Mm-hmm. That's really important. Doesn't mean everyone has to be in the office, but you have to be able to communicate. And so I think what works is a bit of a blend of things, you know. So, you know, open plan, I love it, apart from when I hate it. So, you know, sometimes it's like too noisy and, you know, therefore you've got to have access to private space as well. And, you know, you still also need to be able to communicate on a regular basis. And I think it's just having an environment where people feel, you know, natural and feel that they can sort of, you know, do just get on with their stuff. And, you know, whether it's, you know, 6 hours in the day or whether it's 1 hour in the day. Mm. I mean, I've once again learned over the years, it's not how many hours you work, it's how effective you are. Unfortunately, I still work long hours, but, you know, it's...
Have you not got around that one yet?
I just like working. No, I don't like working. It works for me. Getting up, going to the office. I don't have to, but I do. And it's partly around being part of that tribe. You know, it's a sort of a team thing. Mm. You know, so I'm terrible working by myself. I have done it for about 6 months, and I watched a lot of Test cricket on TV, and I didn't enjoy it at all. So I need to be around, you know, people. And I think also having good coffee, that's really, really important. I'm not talking about, you know, Nespresso capsules. I mean, we're talking about proper coffee and a barista, of course, on site, full restaurant facilities. I mean, it's, you know, sadly I've not necessarily had that, but, you know, close to good food.
Absolutely.
So you've got to have, once again, around the office, you know, just great sort of food, you know, just, you know, maybe not retail
Sounding
therapy.
Great. We'll come and work at your place.
And, of course, the climate. You know, just the thought of working in the Nordics, you know, where...
In winter.
In winter, you know, where you leave, it's dark. Yeah. When you get home, it's dark. And, you know, there's like a few hours of what could be sunshine. So give me at least 12 hours of sunshine. You know, a bit of rain occasionally is fine, but temperate weather. And also I want to see the ocean.
You don't ask for much, do you?
No. Now that you're asking me the question, yeah. It's opening up quite nicely.
Yeah.
And, of course, the ability to, you know, sort of teleport anywhere I want to.
Yeah, of course.
The helicopter, of course, would be useful. Now, the list goes on, but it's, there's so many elements that should work, but it's very hard to bring them all together.
Yeah, great. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. It was great
to
speak to you.
A real pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Without Borders. If you like what you've heard, why not subscribe? And if you want to find out more about Taito and what we're up to, you can find us at taitopr.com. That's TYTOPR.com.